Hello and welcome to this episode of the Outdoors Adventure Podcast. I'm Rob, I'm your host. I hope you're well. In this week's episode, we have an interview with Emma Linford discussing all things right to roam, mountain leading, and everything in between. So yes, hello, I hope you're all well. Welcome along to another episode of the Outdoors Adventure Podcast. As alluded to in the intro, we have an interview today with Emma Linford. Emma is an international mountain leader, writer and campaigner, and she is part of the organisation of The Stars Are For Everyone. That's initially what got me interested in talking to Emma. The Stars Are For Everyone are a campaign group trying to provide a better access to the outdoors and our responsibility to Wild Camp on Dartmoor and other national parks too. So obviously that's a topic of interest and discussion in the outdoors community at the moment, and has been for a long time and will continue to be forever. Our access to the outdoors and how we access it and the legalities around it and the environmental issues surrounding it and all that sort of stuff. So that's initially what got me interested in talking to Emma, and we have a fantastic conversation surrounding those issues. However, if you look into Emma a little bit deeper, she has an incredible past in the outdoors as well. She is an international mountain leader. She guides and she writes, and she's got an incredible career in the outdoors herself. She's got a huge amount of experience leading expeditions, and she speaks incredibly passionately about the outdoors. It was a fantastic interview. I really enjoyed speaking to Emma, and I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I do. So, we will crack on with the interview. Okay, so today I'm here with Emma Linford, and you joined us as we're all wrapped up warm in our houses because it's absolutely freezing outside as I record this. Emma Linford is an outdoors professional, writer and campaigner. Now, at this point, I would genuinely do an introduction into your life in the outdoors and what it is exactly that you do. However, looking through your history, it would take me too long to do that because you've got a huge amount of experience of working in the outdoors. I suppose we'll go into a lot of it in the next however long this takes. The most relevant thing, I guess, at the moment to a lot of people will be your work with the Stars Are For Everyone campaign, which is essentially fighting for our right to roam. However, going back, was the outdoors and working in the outdoors always going to be your path? Was it something that you were interested in from an early age? And welcome, Emma.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for taking me way back to those days. I've had a long travel, a long journey since those days. The time where we choose where we are going to go, the outdoors didn't feature at all, really, only in a sense of doing it for fun. But I think that if we're talking about where I talk about embodiment and this kind of feeling of memories being an embodied experience, an experience in body. And I think those first experiences for me came when I was just trespassing, funnily enough, as a kid with a bunch of friends in a wood, with a lagoon or a lake. And it was actually being fed, this lake, by wastewater from a water plant, from a paper producing plant. But that didn't deter us. And we were making dens and rafts across this. So that's kind of, you know, this was small adventures out the backyard, trespassing in a wood. And I think from then that has stuck with me as a way to explore and a way to be in community and working with others on little problems. So I think it was set in place then, but I never thought I would be in the outdoors.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, it sounds very similar to a lot of people's early years. You've developed that on to the point where you've had an incredible history working in the outdoors. You've worked as an international mountain guide in polar regions, mountain regions, jungle. You've worked with incredible people, and now you're an inspiring character fighting for everyone's right to roam across the UK. Fill in those gaps then a little bit for us. So you've got your early years, you've been out making dens, playing in the woods, playing in lakes, as many people in their younger years do. It's quite a big jump to then get into international guiding, which you've been doing for 20 years. What, fill in that gap a little bit there for us. What was it, something that you sort of chose to do? You researched? Was it something you fell into? How did that sort of come up, working in the outdoors full time, come about for you?
Well, I think it's always one experience follows another, and you have to reflect on those experiences. So if you reflect on the beginning of my life or my teens after those early days, I was introduced to caving and being in the outdoors in an outdoor pursuit club at sixth form. And then I did my bronze Duke of Edinburgh. And then actually I was also very sporty. So I represented the county for three different sports, and I was represented nationally for badminton, actually. So I was that kid a little bit on the periphery when people are, you know, having their coffee inside in the sixth form before their first lessons. I was doing laps outside in the freezing cold to keep my training up. And then I actually went into design and advertising. Reflecting back now on it, just a small point, which I now realise is like the heart of consumerism and capitalism, the beating heart of that, which is, so my journey has come a long way because I'm completely opposed to that now. So at about the age of 23, I realized my journey working in London as a creative wasn't what I expected. And an opportunity came up to go on a rally international expedition to Belize for 3 months. And that gave me a completely different perspective of our society and our culture. And I came back from that knowing, because it's a learned experience, you can't really let go. What am I going to do now? I've got a different perspective of my society and culture. I didn't feel that I fit in, but I also came back going, this has really, really changed me and affected me, and I want to be an expedition leader. So that was the real change in me. But it wasn't until 6 years later that I made that change, because as we know, it's quite difficult to extract ourselves from typical jobs and careers and industry.
Yeah, it's quite a big jump, isn't it? You're not the first person that I've spoke to, by the way, who've cited Rally International as being their inspiration to make the outdoors a wider part of their life. The interview would have gone out by the time I send this one out, but Cressida Allwood, who works for the BMC, also cited them as the organisation who helped her develop her love for the outdoors more than she already had.
I think if you speak to many people like John Gupta, who I work for, who's led Everest a few times, he also started with being a creative soul plus Rally International.
Yeah, absolutely. You also mentioned caving. I would like to say, by the way, that would probably put off a lot of people about getting into the outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm not a caver. It doesn't interest me too much at all, and it hasn't. But I'm also not particularly afraid of it. So I go down there with groups of kids, and I'm, you know, encourage them. But it's not a passion of mine just adding that in.
Yeah, so I mean, it's inspiring to hear already, because you've made that jump from the corporate world into making the outdoors a part of your life. But that's a much simplified way of saying it, making that jump. You've said it's taken you 6 years to make that jump. Throughout those 6 years, were you sort of continually working on, say, your outdoor skills? Were you doing courses? Were you trying to get your mountain leader qualification whilst working? Was it something you were developing along the way?
Yeah. So interestingly, when I came back, I couldn't quite understand why I couldn't live on £20 a day as I was living in Guatemala. And so I went on the dole for about 6 months because I wanted to change. In fact, when I was on the expedition, I introduced myself as, "Hi, I'm a Linford. I used to be a designer." So when I came back, I can, you know, now see it took me 6 years. It was actually quite difficult to extract myself. Now I'm going for another transition, and I believe in transitions in life because we all grow, and which is not taking so long because I understand what we have to do. But I realized we need to earn some money. And the only thing I could do at that time, my skill set, was being a designer. So I went back into design. At that time I started doing my mountain leader. So I did all the training for that, and I was doing quite a lot of going up to the Peak District and back for experience. And then I think at the age of 30, after I bought my house, I realized actually my house was a security for, if it all goes wrong, at least I've got my house. I'm going to take this jump. So yeah, that gave me a bit of a boost.
It's a lovely mentality to have, though, because a lot of people wouldn't think that. A lot of people would think, I've worked hard to get this house and I'm not going to risk it. So it's inspiring to hear that you saw your house as actually enabling you to get into the outdoors more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one to think around this, because it's also been a tie. So it's been brilliant financially. It's been something to come back to, but it's also a tie. My house is in Cambridge. So it does have its pros and cons, and it's something. Yeah, I was very lucky at the time because it was when house prices were low, blah, blah, blah. But I do believe I would have made that change if that wasn't the case, because I think we can only live in our body for a certain amount of time if our body's telling us it doesn't want to be there, because our body tells us, our body starts breaking down, which is also what happened when I was in design. I started to get a lot of stress-induced allergies, and when, you know, when your body shows you, it manifests in a particular way in your body. So I would have left anyway.
Fair enough. Yeah, you do hear that quite often, and I suppose mental health covers a lot of stuff, but you hear a lot about mental health issues these days and the benefit of the outdoors. And sort of working, getting your work-life balance correct. So I guess you were sort of an early thought leader with that, because if that was all those years ago, it wasn't such a big thing in those days. People didn't really talk about mental health and your work-life balance as much back then. I've got to say, Cambridge, not necessarily known as being the hotbed of outdoors activities. How do you find living in Cambridge and making the outdoors a bigger part of your world?
So as for many people, I believe we all have different, you know, we're not just one thing. Okay. So I still have that creative part of my body. And so it's always nice to come back and do like mini creative projects. But it has worked for me in the past, because I used to go away for an amount of time, maybe overseas. And then Cambridge is this like most unthreatening place you could come back to. So it was really good recovery place. That's how I saw it. I think since the pandemic, however, when I was in the house, it has shown me and told me that it doesn't benefit me from being here a very long time, because I think my body is used to expressing itself in a wilder way because it's used to more remote world environments. So yeah, it's not benefiting me being here. So that's one of my things at the moment, is where shall I position myself? But I can also say that I've done a lot of exploring around East Anglia since then. So this is, we're talking about nearby nature and uncovering what's on our doorstep. And although people might expect it to be dull because it's flat, does dull and flat mean boring? Actually, no, it doesn't. If you start uncovering some of the, it's called deep mapping, actually. If you start uncovering some of the myth, legends, geology, flora and fauna around this area, it is more interesting or as equal to a different environment. I just see them in different environments now, actually. So there's the wilder, remoter national parks, that's one environment or ecosystem. And here in the Brecks, like in Thetford Forest, for example, that's another environment or ecosystem. And you can do different activities in both. But it's really about uncovering what is there. It's storytelling, opening up that environment.
Yeah, I love that. That's absolutely, really resonates with me. I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the podcast before, but I grew up just down the road from Cambridge, actually, in Bishop Stortford, about half an hour down the M11. And my early years were jumping on my bike, cycling to Hatfield Forest, and just losing myself in this forest with my mates for days. It felt like days on end. I don't know. I think parents were perhaps less worried back then. But I used to go and lose myself in this forest. And that's where my love of the outdoors come from. And it doesn't take much. You don't need... I belittle Cambridge and the East Anglia a little bit by saying it's not a hotbed of outdoor activities. But that's simply because if you're an outdoorsy person in the UK, you tend to migrate towards the Lake District, the Brecon Beacons, Dartmoor, the more usual places, I suppose, that you would a bit more synonymous with the outdoors. But you're absolutely right. Of course, exploring in your own doorstep, there's plenty around there. And in fact, I used to love my holidays to Hunstanton as well.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I'm going to challenge you on what you said about an outdoorsy person. Like, what is the definition of an outdoorsy person? Outdoors is to go perhaps outdoors of our front door, right? Mm. So it's really an outdoorsy person. Most people think have to go and climb mountains elsewhere, but there's many outdoorsy people. There are farmers, there are gardeners, there are ecologists. They're all outdoorsy people, right? So it's just kind of, we need to redefine that right now. As to what that is, because if you just see an outdoorsy person as a mountaineer, it's very restrictive for people, yeah. Because people will see, I'm not an outdoorsy person because I'm not, so I'm not going to try. Do you see what I mean?
No, I like that. I mean, before I press record, I said to you that I tried to be as broad as possible with this podcast, covering all sorts of activities, all sorts of areas of the UK. I suppose the issue that I have is I called it the Outdoors Adventure Podcast. Perhaps the adventure bit might make me a bit more restrictive, and perhaps my mentality is a bit more restrictive than I actually think it is. And perhaps I'm not as inclusive as I thought I was.
Perhaps, but yeah, we're not here to define the words you're using, but it's also interesting, what is an adventure? Right. So an adventure can be outside your doorstep, because an adventure is possibly going into a realm where you don't know what to expect. And I see it as an adventure going on an expedition or an adventure going outside is you have prepared and planned so much, but you actually don't know what's going to happen on your journey. You don't know what you're going to see, feel, and learn. So an adventure could be just at your doorstep.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, looking back at those trips to Hatfield Forest, they were certainly an adventure. I remember taking a tent once, and me and 3 14-year-olds in a tent. It was, yeah, that, I would class that as an early year adventure, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, we're talking about leaving your doorstep and having adventures. You're looking at your outdoors career, if you like. You talk about the fact you got into mountain leading. When I've looked into a little bit of what you've done in terms of those guiding, international guiding, when I look into what you've done, you've worked across the world. You've worked in lots of countries, in lots of different environments. I read somewhere that you've worked on expeditions in polar regions, mountain regions, bush and jungle environments. How did you go from essentially going, right, okay, I've made the decision, this is what I want to do, to then being able to do work in such incredible environments across the world?
One thing, because if you get a certain type of person listening to the podcast, I'm just going to clarify that IML is International Mountain Leader. What you actually do is guide, but there is a qualification called a guide that I am not. So I am an international mountain leader. Just thought I'd clarify before I go on.
No, great, thank you.
That's all right. How did I get into what I've been doing for the last 20 years?
Yeah, essentially. So it's another big jump, isn't it? It's a big jump to go in, I want to make the outdoors a bigger part of my life. I want to become an international mountain leader, to then working in these incredible environments and actually getting work in all these countries that you've worked in.
Yeah. So I had a lot of confidence in myself as a physical body because I've been very sporty. And then I just made the decision that I needed to go and get my mountain leader because I wanted to be an expedition leader. So I had expedition leader on my mind. So I went up to Lake District and worked at YMCA Lakeside and did some training there for 6 months. And from that, which actually gave me a really a broad range of working with lots of different people, because I was actually super scared with being the front person of a group of people. I'd never done that before. I'd been working on computers in design. And so it actually gave me the confidence to be able to work with corporate teams, young kids, youth, a wide range of people, basically. And then from that point, after 6 months, I then left and went freelance because I wanted to go into expeditioning from then.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. And so you've worked across the world. You've worked in all these amazing environments. Where's your favourite environment? Is that a really horrible question to ask?
What's the specific question? What's your favourite environment to work
environment
in?
Environment to work now, in. Do you like, if you were given the choice to go to a desert environment, a polar environment, a mountain environment, a high altitude environment, a jungle environment, where would you be most excited to go? Let's do both.
Okay. Where my body feels great is in the jungle, actually.
Oh, okay. Amazing.
I really love it. It's so visceral. All my senses are provoked. And I feel part of the jungle because your sweat, it's like 90% humidity. That, and also probably because my earliest memories from Belize were I was in the jungle for one to one and a half months living in it. So that's probably, the jungle is one of my favorites. And I also love being near the coastline and sea. As for my body, as for where else would be, I pretty love going to, I lead a guide in the Alps every summer, so I quite like doing that now. To be honest, I like every environment, but I struggle more with very cold environments.
Okay, why is that?
I think my body type isn't great for that because I'm quite a small female. So as females are known for just being, you know, running cold, they say. Yeah. Mm.
And did I read somewhere that you were involved in the Frozen Planet team?
Yeah, no, not the Frozen Planet team, training the Frozen Planet. So I did, okay. Yeah, do you want me to
elaborate? Yeah, dive into that, because that's a fairly cold environment.
Yeah, so I was involved in a polar organisation for about 8 years, and I was responsible for selecting and training and leading people who wanted to be polar explorers or polar travellers. And that took me also to training part of the Frozen Planet team. So, yeah, that's what I did for 8 years. And most of that work was, it started in Devon on Dartmoor, and then it went out to Svalbard. And then I've done expeditions in the Canadian Arctic in the Northwest Passage.
Oh, how amazing. All amazing places.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they're pretty stunning. I'm very grateful for all the experiences I've had. Very lucky.
Yeah. And you mentioned before that you weren't comfortable initially sort of being the leader, being out front. How does it make you feel these days to be in, if you're in charge of an expedition, for example, in charge of a load of people? How do you feel about it now that you've got a bit of experience under your belt?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much like putting on slippers now. I think, I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, and it isn't. It still isn't comfy, as slippers, because you don't know what's going to happen. But I'm confident that I can deal with any situation that might arise within that group of people. And more comfortable with dealing with different types of people, i.e. you have to change your leadership style. I call it chameleon leadership, depending on what group and what individuals you'll get in that team or group of people. And each one needs to be held individually. And each one is coming for a different type of growth or, wherever they are in their life, they're bringing themselves to this space that needs to be held individually with care. So as a facilitator, you need to, it's a very difficult but also privileged position to be in. If I'm guiding or leading a group of 18-year-old boys, I have to change my leadership to what it would look like with 18-year-old girls, for example. And that has only come with experience.
I like the term you use as well, the facilitator, rather than leader or guide. Facilitator.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, we are an enabler. We're an enabler of people. That's what we're doing. I actually see us as key workers. We are super important in introducing people to the outdoors and holding them through whatever they're choosing to do in the outdoors, whether it's a journey, a trek, or a climb, or whatever. A key worker. We kind of hold that super importance. We also kind of use the term illuminator as well, because there's a lot of psychology involved in it. And I've also done, led a lot of expeditions, therapeutic expeditions. So, yeah, there's many terms that can be combined into this word facilitator.
I like that. And what I suppose you've touched on, you've sort of mentioned the importance of being able to facilitate people into challenging themselves and getting more into the outdoors. From your perspective, why is it so important that people have this connection with the outdoors?
That's
It's a deep question.
It's a deep and interesting question. So, and I would have answered it differently back then than I do now. But I think now I'm going to answer it as I do now is we as humans are part of nature. We are nature. Okay. We're born from the same things that is outside of our front door. Okay. But we have lost, sadly, that connection to it. Hence the problems and the crisis we're seeing today. So yes, we need to reconnect with it for our mental health, but we also need to reconnect with it to be able to understand that nature is a part of us and we need to care for and be compassionate towards it. Because, you know, with the crisis, all we've been doing is being extractive and taking from and not giving back, not being reciprocal.
Yeah, I'm sat here with a big grin on my face because although you're talking about the challenges that as a society we're going through, the amount of times on previous podcasts that I have basically said exactly what you said, it's so obvious to someone who, you know, I've got good mental health, I would say. I don't really struggle too much. But even I have blips. And when you have a blip, all I really need to do is to get into nature, get outside. And I tell my wife, it's like a little reset button in the back of my head. And if I just click that reset button, I'm back again. And the benefits that the outdoors can bring are huge. And I've said exactly the same as you previously. We're animals, and yet we behave so unanimal-like. And with modern technology and modern stress, and the fact that we're so detached from the outdoors these days, to me, it's obvious. Put two and two together, and perhaps that's why there's such a huge problem with mental health these days.
Yeah, it's also because we're told to be a certain way. And nature, I'm talking about nature, I'm talking about outdoors, and that is anywhere. I see anywhere as wild. Well, not necessarily completely coutured gardens, but that's a different conversation. But like nature, we are expressive creatures that hold a lot of energy, and we can't just be contained. The outdoors gives us a place to go and express ourselves, to be with different energy. That might sound a little bit hippie-ish, but you know, that for example, I will go down to the river, which is around the corner from me, and sometimes in Cambridge the river is grey, the clouds are grey, call it a concrete sky, and it feels totally oppressive. And then my energy will say, I need to go to the sea and be with the waves because I feel like that in my body. So I'm quite in tune with what energies I need because I've been in different types of places. But yes, we need to be out there connecting with, we need facilitators. So I'm kind of going into the future now, but facilitators to bring and storytell the environment alive for us, because we're only actually seeing it as good for ourselves. There's good for ourselves, but we don't actually know much about it. Most people don't know what particular type of trees they are, for example, you know, and what ecosystems they hold, who and what trees host within them, you know, in that community. So, you know, I can talk about that for a while, but maybe go back to where you were.
Well, no, we're definitely going to get into all that sort of stuff because I can see how your passion for facilitating people into the outdoors and utilizing nature to help people's mental health led you on to your Stars of Everyone work and helping with the Right to Roam fight. We'll come on to that very, very soon. I suppose the question to ask would be, we talk about the benefit of the outdoors for people's mental health quite a lot, but actually there's quite a big benefit to people's physical health as well and how that can benefit them too. Would that direct you in the right?
Yeah, definitely. Very big benefit to physical health. Obviously, you've got endorphins that come off, doing trail running, for example, or climbing, or, you know, climbing can give you, well, a lot of these can give you quite meditative effects. It's just another experience, another perspective than the one you are being taught and the one you are told you need to keep within. It's a different framework. And I feel for people to grow and understand themselves, which is really why I went into the outdoors, is about for social transformation. Because if we can grow and understand ourselves and communicate in a healthier, better way with other people, we will form better relationships with other people. We will form better relationships with the outdoor world. Okay. And humans need relationships. Humans have an innate need to belong. Okay, so it gives us, the outdoors gives us a place we can belong to. And how, you know, what's more important than that?
No, I couldn't agree more.
A place where people's relationships are breaking down all over the world, in our homes, we can maintain or grow or cultivate a relationship with our, we call it other than human kin. Yeah, outdoors, our tree outdoors, our national park in the Lake District. We can create a relationship. We can belong to that.
I can see the passion that you have for this subject, and I can see exactly why you fight for enabling access to the outdoors. So moving on to that line of work, obviously it's been incredibly relevant this year, particularly.
Can I just butt in again?
Of course,
I want to say, but I didn't come to this place that I hold now without the journey I've been on. And it is an inquiry to me, how can I help others get to this place without going through the competition, pushing, striving, being the best, getting to the top of the summit that I've been on and that others need to do. They need, there's you know, a whole gamut of people outdoors that are calling themselves adventurers. They are adventurers, but there is also underlying this need for self-worth and that is missing relationally from their, probably the way how they were brought up from their earlier years. So they're needing to use the outdoors to summit that mountain. That, you know, there's something quite psychologically, it's not wrong, it's just what there's something lacking that they need. And actually, until you get to that summit, sometimes you don't need, you know, you need that. So through my 30s, for example, I pushed my body extremely hard. I was I did adventure racing, which is a team event of between two and four people, and you can get expedition adventure races. My longest was in the National Adventure Racing Championships with a team of four people. And it was for 4 days. And, you know, I've just whacked my body and pushed it. And I've whacked my body and pushed it through expeditions in the Arctic, for example. You know, this is proper survival in, it was minus 52, it was minus 45 ambient conditions, minus 52 with wind chill. You know, that's proper hard. I won't go in those conditions now. But I've kind of had to go through that. I've learned so much about myself. I don't need to push. I don't need to compete. I don't need to do that. I am just in that position of enjoying and getting to know what's around me. I just went from A to B before. And that's what a lot of people are doing. And that's the problem. Like even Duke of Edinburgh now, it gives you an introduction to the outdoors. But a lot of the expedition is really about let's go from A to B. Let's not journey through this landscape and learn about it. Let's get to A to B. So how can we invite people to be within the outdoors and not have to have a goal to succeed is a question.
Oh, I like that. You talk about enabling others to use the outdoors for their benefit. You seem to be in a position now where you completely understand your mind, your body, how the outdoors helps you. For you, was it a developmental process? Did it happen over a number of years? Or was there sort of a light bulb moment where it sort of came to you and thought, ah, I can put two and two together now?
Yeah, I think it was over a number of years. Well, I suppose I looked at my position, and you form an identity, don't you? But I formed an identity of Emma who could do really extreme hard stuff as a female, which was quite rare, right? And that was actually a dangerous place to be, because I realized at age 40 that I didn't know what self-care was. I couldn't do things that were softer, because I put myself in this leader position of holding others, listening to others, and, you know, that found it super, you know, I was super drained by it all, actually. So also my, how I viewed my position in the outdoors then as well was, as a leader, you need to be more comfortable than the people that you are holding. And so I viewed myself as physically strong. I could, you know, endure. I could understand others. I could listen, because I was really comfortable in the outdoors. So that's how I positioned myself at the beginning. Very energetic. But then, as I've just said, I got to a stage where I understood that that wasn't sustainable. So it has happened over a number of years. Yeah.
Okay. So moving on from there, we need to have access to the outdoors to be able to do this, which leads us on to a lot of work that you've been doing this year with the Stars Are For Everybody. Do you want to just touch on what that is?
Yeah. So Stars For Everyone was a organization that's come out of a small group of people down in Totnes that got wind of the fact that Mr. Alexander Darwell, who is a wealthy landowner down there, was going to deny people on Dartmoor the chance to wild camp, which had been thought that was a custom for the last 30, 40 years. And so a small group was formed. This was last October, of which there was about five of us in there. And so from then, we have gone through this process of putting on the largest land protest since the Kinder mass trespass 100 years ago. But where it's at the moment, we've managed to, it's not we, but a whole consortium, a whole coalition, including Dartmoor National Park, who the case was against, have managed to put wild camping back on the map. But at the moment, as it stands, Mr. Darwell has just submitted his defence to the Supreme Court. So the campaign still continues.
Okay, I mean, you mentioned the mass trespass, or the 3,500 gathering that you got together. How did that feel? Because from someone outside looking in, that seemed absolutely incredible to get something like that with those numbers, to really put a message out there that, you know, we're not happy about this situation. And I've got to say, from somebody who hasn't been on, who wasn't there, who hasn't been to London, you know, I've campaigned on social media and from the outside and using this podcast as a campaign, but from someone outside looking in, thank you. thank you for taking the front step and doing this for the outdoors community. Because, you know, without you and others, it would have been lost. So how did it make you feel when you got those 3,500 people together?
It was pretty balmy. It was balmy and unexpected. Yeah. So from the first, in December last year, standing outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London doing our first protest, and then I actually went into the court case and sat behind Mr. Darwell and was listening to the court case, and I was just, it just kind of occurred to me how much was just reliant on a single word of what wild camping was and what it was in the 1949 Act, and the fact that it hadn't been named in that, and the dispute over whether it was recreation or whether it was staying in one spot. It didn't attend to anything that I knew about the outdoors and how good it was for people. It was really about its structure and function. And so there was no talk about the developmental growth for youth, no talk about mental health. And so, yeah, so from that, within me, I had this super sense of injustice that had come from, I think, attending COP26 as well, and various other things. But so as a group of people went from 5 to 13 getting this rally to go ahead, we thought we were going to get 100 people to attend. And then bit by bit, we realised the Eventbrite numbers were going up and up and up. And we're like, oh my goodness, we're actually going to have to put on transport from train stations and ferry people into this site. So it was, and this was within 2 weeks, this was absolutely balmy. It was massive for me. I had a huge part in it, arranging it. And I also had the privilege of speaking right at the beginning. It was just super wonderful seeing all of those people supporting the cause. And I think it's, you know, the movement will continue.
Absolutely. If you're into the outdoors, it is a huge pressure point, and it's something that we're all passionate about. And I think, I mean, the issue for me is, you know, I wild camp in various parts of the UK, so technically I endorse an illegal activity. But the reason why I wild camp is exactly the reasons why you mentioned before, when you sat behind Alexander Darwell. Nobody touched on the benefits of doing this thing. It's black and white when it comes to the legal case, isn't it? Or they attempt to make it black.
That's correct.
But, you know, I will continue to wild camp in upland areas, and I'll continue to wild camp responsibly. And the big thing for me, and the thing that, you know, that makes me so passionate about it, is I can, A, see the benefit to people's mental and physical well-being, but also specifically regarding the land that Alexander Darwell was concerned about. I'm right in saying that the 10 Tours was affected. I'm right in saying that various Duke of Edinburgh expositions or routes were affected. And these are young people that are, we're trying to influence positively to get into the outdoors, that were essentially affected by this decision.
Well, actually, there was a fear that they were going to be affected, and this is what the fight was for. But Dartmoor National Park, to mitigate that, made a deal, or the landowners made a deal with Dartmoor National Park, that people can continue with wild camp unless, as long as Dartmoor National Park paid the landowners. So that's what happened. There was this like very underhand deal going on that stripped Dartmoor National Park for more funds to enable the youth to continue with their expeditions. And also at that time, some of the land was withdrawn from various landowners, so that wild camping map that did exist was reduced. So it did have some effect, but, you know, fair dues to Dartmoor National Park. They made a deal, but that's also what we were campaigning against. We shouldn't have to be paying landowners to wild camp.
Absolutely. It's coming out of taxpayers' expense rather than a human right.
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm going to touch on two points. I've noted that when I was thinking about this a few days ago, I started thinking about the broader picture. The two points that perhaps might be conceived as controversial, you might not like one of them, but I think they're important to raise. There's sort of two questions here, so I'll go through both points and we'll address them individually. But the first one is, I'd like to get your opinion on the Instagram generation. Let's put it out there. Let's just say it as it is. I'd like to get your opinion on whether you think the battle for more access to the outdoors is being hindered by what is perceived to be a more modern day issue, in the sense that, and a lot of people cite post-COVID. A lot of people cite COVID as the reason why a lot of people want to get into the outdoors more. And a lot of people cite the fact that there's now less responsible wild campers out there who are there to get a good Instagram picture, who will light a fire, who will leave the litter, who will leave their tent. And a lot of people cite the fact that that's increased. I'd like to get your opinion on that, on whether you feel that's an issue or if it's just the fact that it's more prevalent, if it is more prevalent, or whether it's just the fact that due to social media, it's more shared when it does happen. And then the second thing, you might not like this, but playing devil's advocate, can you see any point that the Darwals have? Can you see it from their perspective? Do you think that actually they do have genuine concerns about litter, fires, damage to their land? And playing devil's advocate, can you see anything from their perspective? And do you think it's about working together to get the right level of responsibility from people who use the land as a entertainment aspect? So there's sort of two parts there. Not the easiest things to think about. Not the
That's
easiest
all
things
right.
to address.
I think I'll
slightly
I'll,
controversial I'll, some of them, but points that people raise.
No, not at all. I'll answer the second one first. Actually, okay. Can I see Darwell's perspective? I don't know Darwell. I don't know. It feels like his perspective. I'm just going to go back to, I don't know Alexander Darwell. All I know is he does not want people camping on his land, giving the reasons of litter and burning. Actually, evidence suggests that there hasn't been too much of that happening. Evidence to the contrary is the trespass group down in Devon, now South Devon, trespass group has been on his land quite a few times and seen an awful lot of pheasant shoot, rubbish, cartridges, etc., that are also harmful to the land. He, as a landowner, is being paid an awful lot of money from the government to care for, to uphold, to steward the land, and he obviously also is not doing that. So I think there's also that perspective. I think that I like to see conversations happen, and it's not an us and them. And this feels like it is a class war, but all of these wars come down to not understanding the other's perspective, right? It's understanding difference. And I think that's one of the problems here. In the courtroom, I actually went up to speak to Mr. Darwell to ask if I could have a conversation. And he declined, which was sad for me. But it shows the amount of fear that can happen between two parties that perceive other people in a way that is conflicting to their own perspective. Actually, what we're doing now is quite a lot of outreach work with some of the landowners down there. We're going down to help them. For example, a couple of my colleagues went down to help one of the landowners gather acorns, and whilst having a conversation about wild camping. So kind of working in tandem to understand their perspective and for them to understand ours. At the moment, what's happening is they are understanding ours, and where they were super against it, There was one landowner, for example, that was filmed in the early days talking about sick and detritus in a sleeping bag being left on his land, is now one of the main proponents of widening the World Camping Map. You know, so this is about outreach and conversations.
Mm.
So I think that's my answer to that one.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Okay.
Do you think the plight has been made harder by my first point?
By the Instagram generation.
I hate that
continual
term.
Posting.
I hate that term because you're generalizing. You're generalizing a certain demographic, but perhaps newcomers who might not know or understand the general sort of ethos around wild camping.
So I don't know how much has been posted. I get alerted occasionally about, you know, there's been fires in the Peak District, et cetera, et cetera. But let's come down to, it all boils down to the same point, which is education. And education that can be provided by the national parks and education that can be provided by schools to enable kids to go outside and learn and understand how to behave in a responsible manner in the outdoors. This is really what it is. This isn't so. Instagram is really. I'm just going to go back to education.
That's fine.
That's okay. Yeah. So national parks have been stripped of an awful lot of funding. For example, Dartmoor probably only has one ranger there, and what we need to ensure is they are provided with funds to go and educate people before they go outdoors. What we're actually finding is a lot of the culture that is now surrounding what is perceived as wild camping has come from festival camping. People perceive wild camping to be festival camping because they're in a field and there's limited toilets. And so they therefore think that they can take their festival ways and, you know, pop it in a national park and that is okay, which isn't okay. So yeah, there needs to be a lot of more education around that to, you know, break that understanding down of what it is.
It just comes down to the same. I think you always talk about it, communication's key, isn't it? It's about communicating the needs of landowners, the request of landowners, and the needs and requests of those who want to use the land.
There's always going to be the people that are not responsible everywhere. We get that everywhere, whether they're rural or urban.
Mm.
But if we can touch the masses with a system that upholds the values of how do we respond responsibly in the outdoors, then that's going to be huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
In education, for example, when kids get to the age of 7 or 8, if they've had the privilege to go to forest schools and, you know, be taught outside and be allowed to explore, it stops at 7 and 8. Until you might get to doing D of E at 14, but that's not for everyone. That's what is the main trouble with our education system today is people are they're not able to expand and draw on and grow their knowledge of being in the outdoors.
Mm. Yeah, I was at the Kendall Mountain Festival last week and they were talking about the disconnect.
Oh, me too.
Oh, were you? Oh, I didn't bump into you. There was a talk going on about, in fact, there was a landowner there. There was a landowner, there was the BMC, and it was a right to roam talk. And the lad from the BMC raised a really interesting point. He was saying the UK as a whole, in terms of if you look at the disconnect to nature or the connection to nature, there must be a way you can measure that because apparently they have measured it. And the UK as a whole is more disconnected to nature than the rest of Europe. But actually, if you look at Scotland, they're the most connected out of the rest of the UK. Scotland have got the most relaxed laws when it comes to right to roam. England doesn't. And that disconnect also translates, and his point he made was it translates to the way that you look after your environment as well. So the more connected to the outdoors you are, the more you want to look after that environment. And they did quite a simple survey. And basically it was the amount of littering that you do individually as a person. Now, obviously the outdoors community, you would hope, is fairly low down those charts. But there's a really strong synergy between having a connection to the outdoors and not littering. Also, connection to nature and not littering versus having that disconnect. It's obvious, isn't it? But by blocking access to the outdoors, you're going to create more disconnect.
Absolutely. And I think who you're talking about there is Trash Free Trails. And it's a really brilliant but simple but brilliant initiative to connect people to the outdoors. I fully support them. And yes, we are the 14th out of 14 countries most disconnected in Europe.
Well, I mean, thank you for all you're doing to try and help us alleviate that issue by helping us gain more access.
No problem. Yeah, I'm a member of the Right to Roam family, wider family, and a few of us have contributed to a book by Nick Hayes, who wrote the Trespass Companion Guide to Trespass. And this book is going to be coming out on the anniversary of the Kinder Trespass next year, April the 21st. And this book is going to be referring to and alluding to and promoting the momentum going forwards of this disconnect to nature. And it's going to be used over the next 20 years to provide a platform to go further into connecting with nature. And comes with the premise, if we don't have access to nature, how can we care for it? The book is called Wild Service, A Culture of Belonging and Care. And I wrote the section on education. So look out for that.
Excellent. That sounds incredibly interesting. I'll definitely be looking for that. Listen, I've absolutely loved this chat today. We have covered so much. It's been absolutely incredible. It sort of makes me want to do a bit of a follow-up, see where we are in a year's time. But it just so happens we've spent sort of about 20 minutes on your outdoors experience, about 20 minutes on the benefits of the outdoors, and 20 minutes on the Right to Roam starter for everyone. So it's been a nice little sectionable chat today. I've really enjoyed it. There's one question that I always ask everyone when I come to the end of a chat. It allows you to throw in a bit of a curveball, actually. Maybe something that's not outdoors related, I don't know. The one question I always ask is, what's the one thing about yourself that when you tell people surprises them the most?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. So I would answer when I get very weird expressions is when people ask my age. They're very taken aback by it because they think I'm 10 years younger. That's one thing. But I also asked my sister this yesterday. She said, absolutely nothing. It wouldn't surprise me. And then she said, if you went out and bought the Daily Mail, that would surprise me.
Okay, there we go. There we go. Well, I'm not going to ask you your age because I was taught as a boy, you're not supposed to ask a lady's age. But you don't look a day over 21.
Hey, right answer.
Lovely. Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's genuinely been an excellent conversation. If people want to find you or find your work or get in touch with you, where's the best place to send them?
I'm highly unmarketable. I'm highly unmarketable. I'm not very social media-y. No, that's the word. You can cut all of that out. You can find me on Instagram at @m_Linford. It's probably the best place to find me. Perfect. Yeah. Okay.
I'll put all the links to everything you're doing on the show notes. Lovely. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob. It was brilliant.
So thank you for listening to this episode of the Outdoors Adventure Podcast. I hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I enjoyed doing it. Like I say, fascinating interview, some real insights there into various aspects of the outdoors, some of which we might not considered previously. All good stuff. Next episode I've got planned, I'll probably leave this in the feed for a couple of weeks, and then we have a trip report episode, another body from Wales. Fantastic trip we had to Nantsidian Bothy. So stay tuned for that one in a couple of weeks' time. See you next time.